This is the Aeon Bide interview, and with us we have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Lance Owens to discuss Tolkien and other sundries. How are you doing today, Lance?
I'm doing fine.
Thank you very much for joining Aeon Bite. Although most people would not make a connection between Jung and Tolkien, besides there being plenty of Jungian analysts of Tolkien, there seems to be many parallels to both giants of our times, and you certainly point out a few in your excellent lectures at Gnosis.org. Perhaps the first one, or the main one, as you mentioned, is the similar experiences they both had before World War I. What were they, Lance?
It's a big question, because it's a question about the nature of human imagination. It becomes apparent that Tolkien had a deep experience of the imaginal realm. You know, we think of the imagination as something safely locked inside the cranium. And what we imagine is a mere refiguration of images that have come to us through sensory perception. In other words, everything locked in that cranium has sort of come into it through our physical relationship to incarnation, shall we say.
Okay.
There are individuals who have a different perception. They encounter the imaginal as something independent, as a second reality, that is independent of their experience. In other words, what comes to them through the imagination can include things that have not been part of their sensory perception, that are not locked within their cranium. It's like they're like the vision is a doorway. There's a doorway, and one can look out into the world, and one can also look in that doorway and find as great an infinite reality. This is it's a very strange concept. If one simply is locked in a flatlands worldview where there's only one reality and it's all material, this makes no sense. But there are individuals who've had this experience of an inner reality, an imaginative reality. Tolkien most definitely was one. And Jung most definitely was one. You know, I think probably at this point in our culture, there are very few people who have not heard the name of John Ronald Reuel Tolkien. And of the most published books in history, I think Lord of the Rings is up there near the top right now, something like 250 million copies in print. And then The Hobbit follows shortly thereafter. So, you know, people are aware of Tolkien's literary production. They're aware of The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, but hardly any of that reading public is aware of what preceded those books. That this man had a 20-year engagement with an imaginal realm and produced boxes upon boxes upon boxes of manuscripts, thousands of pages of manuscripts documenting his encounter with the imaginal. He saw the imaginal as a given thing, as a reality, as an independent truth. He did not feel that he was inventing anything. And this, he repeats this again and again in his letters, in his private conversations, that his experience of the imaginal was an experience of a reality, that a truth, and that the stories that he was telling were not invented by him. They were translations of his experience of the imaginal. It's a strange concept, but that is the depth that people perceive when they read The Lord of the Rings. There's something deeper there. When did this start for Tolkien? Well, it started around the time of the beginning of the First Great War, the World War I, as we call it. Around the time, around 1914, Tolkien began having a sense of a deeper reality that was bidding him to explore it. He began having words coming to him. He called them ghost words. He would hear elven words, words in a language that he had not ever heard before, that no human had heard before. And the words would come with him, not just as sounds, but they would come with meaning. And he began keeping records of these elven words, trying to explore that vocabulary. But the words didn't just come. With the words, there came stories. The elven languages came complete with mythology. And he had started probing it before he himself entered the battle of World War One, over a period between about 1914 and 1916. Now, like, at that point, the man is, he's around 21 to 24 years old, and he doesn't really know exactly what's going on, other than it seems peculiar and no one else seems to understand it. He thinks he perhaps is a poet, and some of his initial fairy mythology and some of his initial vision is written in poetic form. And then in 1916, Tolkien goes to the Battle of the Somme, which was perhaps the most horrendous sacrifice of World War One. A 500,000 men died in 6 months at the Battle of the Somme. 20,000 British soldiers died on the first day of battle, on the first day of July.
Wow.
Of 1916 alone. Amongst the men who died at the Somme were Tolkien's, two of Tolkien's three best friends. He was there for the entire battle. He was a signal officer working on the front lines, trying to maintain communication with the rear, and he witnessed this sacrifice. He came home from battle. In late October, he became ill with a malady then known as trench fever. They didn't know what caused it. The men came down with cyclical recurrent fevers. Now we understand it was probably conveyed by the lice that infested the soldiers in the trenches. So he came home with high fevers and sick in November of 1916 to England. And during that period, in hospital, this imaginal realm really opened up. Certainly, when he came home, there are times when he was actually suffering from high fevers, and he may have even had some hallucinatory events, dream events during that period. But that was not it alone. The fevers were not persistent. But he did spend several months off and on in hospital, and then many, many more months in convalescence where he didn't have much to do. And during that period, he entered into an imaginal relationship, shall we say, with the Elven realm. And he began hearing these incredible stories. And he, once again, his sense was not that he was inventing them, but that he was actually hearing them. And with him came the Elven tongues. So he got home in November of 1916, and 1916 and 1917, and through 1918, he produced a series of stories, a series of imaginal investigations, shall we say, that are really the foundation of everything that followed. And he encountered this realm as a given thing, to use his own words. He began recording these stories. He had no idea exactly where it was going. He didn't understand if it was a literary work, if it was a poetic work, if it was anything that would ever be published. In fact, at the time, this was entirely a private matter, and he kept these things in notebooks. The interesting thing here, and the question you asked to start is, well, how does this relate to Jung? And, the same thing happened to Jung at almost the same time. In 1913, Jung was a doctor of 37 years of age, and had a long period of relationship to Freud, had broken off that relationship, and he had understood that in the psyche there was much more than simply the repressed material of our potty training and our parental relationships that had gone wrong in youth, but that this realm opened out into an infinity, and he realized that he had to meet it, he had to enter into it. So he on the 12th of November of 1913 sat at his desk and petitioned his soul, my soul, where are you?" That's how he wrote his beginning. And he sat for a month probing after some communication back from this imaginal realm, from his soul. He entered into what he called the mythopoetic imagination, the imaginative realm from which myth came. And he was looking for his myth. He was not trying to invent it. He was trying to discover it. Over a period of weeks, he sat, and slowly words started forming. He started hearing phrases and word forms. By December of 1913, things absolutely broke open. He began having visions, full visions. He would sit and he would actually see things, and he recorded them, he recorded these stories, these story fragments. This was the beginning of Jung's Red Book. Originally, these things were written in diaries, in diaries known as the Black Books. And over the next, about 10 years, he filled six journals, six Black Book journals with these events. From these, he distilled a manuscript, which then he transcribed into his Red Book. In 1913, this was before the war had erupted, he was having visions of the coming of a war. Amongst the visionary material he was having, there were many references to a great sacrifice that was about to come. In England, Tolkien was in a very similar situation. He had gone to the Cornish coast in 1914. And while there, he had a vision of one Earendil, he called him. And it came as a poetic fragment. But this word, Earendil, it had come to him from Middle English, and it had some intent. It seemed that this word had existed outside of history, that there was a story connected with it, and he began trying to tell that story of Earendil, one who had sailed into the heavens with a gem of light. Then after the war broke out, and after Tolkien's experience in the war, he came home, and this imaginative realm opened up for him as well. So you have Jung in Zurich having these visions, this entry into the imaginal, into the mythopoetic imagination, developing stories, feeling that there is an infinite reality there to be discovered, a given that must be discovered. Jung says that we perceive the outer reality as infinite, but that there is a reality within just as infinite and just as interesting and just as important, that we are incomplete, we are only half until we encounter that lost and forgotten other within us, that other half waiting to join into consciousness. This experience of Jung is happening around the time of the Great War, and he has images of the sacrifice that's happening around Switzerland. And Tolkien is right there in the middle of the sacrifice. He sees it, he lives through it, he comes home and he starts his own visionary experience. So if one doesn't accept the fact that people can have visionary experiences, this is all, you know, balderdash. I mean, what the hell is going on here? It's hard to get across to people. I remember how I was at a cocktail party talking to somebody about this. I think I mentioned this at one of the lectures. And I was talking about the fact that Tolkien was having these auditory hallucinations of elven words. He was hearing elven languages. He was hearing from the elves their stories, and he was writing them down. And the lady said to me, "What you mean here is that Tolkien was crazy. Is that what you're saying? Tolkien believed in elves." And my response to that was, "Well, no. Tolkien didn't believe in elves. Tolkien knew elves. He knew elves by hundreds of names. He knew their history. He knew their stories. He knew their sorrows and their joys. He knew the beauty of their art. He was discovering elves. He was getting to know them." And the same thing goes with Jung. People say, "Well, what was going on with him? That was he having, you know, he was having these visual hallucinations. Was this a psychotic break? Was he mad? Was this an illness?" My answer to that is no. It wasn't. The man continued to function in every normal fashion. During this event, during the writing of what became the Red Book, he continued to see patients, on average five a day during these years, 1914 through 1919 or so, when he was having the visions, when he was writing the visionary material down. He was on active duty as an officer in the Swiss Army during this period for extended, a total of over a half year. on active duty. He was able to maintain his family function, the rather complex family function, should we add, at this time as well. Tolkien was able to function in England when he was having these visions, when he was writing things down, when he was telling the stories. Some of the time he was definitely in hospital, some of the time he was sick and weakened by his illness, but he was able to function in every fashion outwardly. This was an inner exploration, which was not an impairment of rational function. In fact, it is a turning of rational function, a turning of rational attention, instead of outwardly to the activities of the world, inwardly to the activities of the imagination. So both of these guys were going through this intense experience at about the same time, historically. There's a certain synchronicity there. But even more interesting, I think that, you know, many people have visions of sorts, or imaginations, or hear stories. And it's interesting. Maybe they write it down, and they go on with their life. The difference here is that what happened to Jung between these visionary experiences, I say visionary, but I could also use the word imaginal, or I could use the word mythopoetic, myth-creating. These visions that he had became the foundation of a life of work. Jung saw this visionary material that came to him between 1914 and 1920 as the precious stone that he would work for the rest of his life. He spent the next 45 years trying to explain to the world, to people, to patients, the reality of the soul, the reality of the psyche, the reality of an inner world which was just as infinite as the outer, which was not a result of it, which was not simply the residue of it, but was an independent reality. In fact, it may come before, this imaginal realm might come before outward perception. And then he went and spent 45 years, the rest of his life, as a hermit, as an interpreter to people of this experience, of this reality. And from it came his ideas of a collective unconscious. You know, people once upon a time would say, well, Jung got his theories of the collective unconscious from listening to the dreams of his patients and correlating experiences, or from perhaps his own dreams. Well, the truth of the matter is, he got the concept by the experience of actually having gone into the imaginal realm and encountered these figures. Tolkien, in parallel, had this imaginative experience begin 1914 or thereabouts, then break open in magnitude around 1916, November of 1916, after returning from the Battle of the Somme, and over the next 2 to 3 years, and spent the next 40 years of his life further investigating, exploring, and developing this experience of the imaginal. Both men struggled throughout their entire lives trying to explain what they had encountered, what they had seen, what they had experienced to others. And both struggled, shall we say, with limited success in that effort.
Moving on, Lance, don't you mention in your lecture briefly that the cosmology of Tolkien's universe is very similar to a specific Gnostic myth? Which one is that?
That becomes both an interesting and a complex question. Because first of all, you say, well, you know, Tolkien had a cosmology. Well, what was his cosmology? Where did that come from? People have read The Lord of the Rings, and it's like, is there a cosmology in The Lord of the Rings? or in The Hobbit, is there a cosmology? Is there a cosmological vision? And so you start talking about things like that to people who know something about Tolkien, who've read some of his works, and it's like, what the hell is that about? But the point is that these writings that Tolkien produced are unknown. These writings, the things he wrote around the time of the First World War, his initial Silmarillion, shall we say, his initial stories, are not well known. There are a great number of things that Tolkien wrote that are yet unpublished, but material related to his visions, to his elven stories,
In his own red book, basically.
Yeah, his own red book. And that's exactly what he called it, you know? That's
really?
That's exactly what he called it.
Oh, my God.
Yes, his red book. He worked for 20 years before The Lord of the Rings was engaged in 1937-1938. He worked for 20 years creating this material. The Silmarillion was not a little book. I mean, there was a little book called The Silmarillion published a few years after Tolkien's death, edited by his son Christopher. But this was just a very brief condensation of his mythology. As a matter of fact, Tolkien's Silmarillion filled probably two or three file cabinets. The publisher, after Tolkien's death, he had 8 feet of stacked boxes.
Wow.
That included his manuscripts of what was the Silmarillion. So Christopher Tolkien, his son, after J.R.R.'s death, had the task of trying to bring this stuff to publication. And he initially published a very slim volume called The Silmarillion, which was a recension of some of the primary myths that Tolkien had told. And the first of these is called the Einlindele. And this is when you get into Tolkien texts, this becomes a little bit complicated because many of the texts have elven names. That's how he heard them. And the Einlindele means the music of the gods. So Tolkien went through this initial series of visions. There were maybe three or four crucial myths that came to him, crucial stories. Stories that related to the origin of human consciousness and to the origin of elven consciousness, the origin of the elves, and the relation of elves and men, and the relation of these to the powers, to the emanations, to the gods. There's one called the story of Gondolin, and there's, well, I won't go through all those three or four myths, but in 1919, after these initial three or four myths had come to him, he received a cosmogonic myth, as he calls it, a story of creation, a story that starts before the world and tells the story of world creation. Now, that's, you know, relatively unusual. These are the sorts of things that are the foundations of religions, actually. Cosmogonic myths, how gods form worlds, how god powers interact with human powers, are, for the most part, foundational stories of religions. And Tolkien received just such a cosmogonic myth in the Einlindele. And he sees in this story that he writes, and it's all, the original text is about, probably 10 pages. And there's a good recension of it in the little book, The Silmarillion, published. I think it was 1977. And in the Einlindele, he tells the story of a first force called Lúvatar, who emanates several god forms called the Ainur. And the Ainur come forth from his consciousness, his emanations of consciousness. Each one is a limited form of that consciousness. Each one is a piece of that consciousness, very much like some of the old Gnostic myths where you have the emanational structure of creation. One of these emanations, whose name is Melko, is a emanation of discord. Melko adds into the music of creation from which the cosmos flows forward a tone, a song, a theme of discord. Creation itself comes forward from the force and the song and the music of the gods singing, and the world, the cosmos, is formed thereof. Melko goes into the darkness. There is a void. In this initial creation myth, there's a void where the light of the Lúvatar has not shined. There is a place behind the back, shall we say, of a Lúvatar, the first source, a place where his light, his vision, has not gone. Now think about that. It's a duality. Here we have the first forming god, a Lúvatar, bringing forth emanations. But in that first force, in that first motive, in that first thought, that forethought, there is a realm of unseen, a realm of unconscious or a realm of unperceived. Melko goes into that darkness and goes probing for things. And it's from that darkness that the discord is brought in to the creation. And Melko becomes a force of that discord. The story proceeds after the formation of the world, after the formation has taken place, the Ainur, the emanations of the first god, enter into creation. They actually come down in to the world and become what men would call gods. But there's not one, there are many. And they all have their different elements. There's Manwë, who is really the god of the winds, the intelligence. And he has a syzygy, a female companion, who's Varda, who is the queen of stars, the creator of the first lights. And people from the readers of Lord of the Rings will remember her as Elbereth, Gilfronniel, you know, star queen, star creator, to whom Sam prays when they meet Shelob in the caves of Tir Thungul. There is a force of the water, Ulmo, who's really a prophetic voice. There's Aule, who is a creator, a manipulator of matters. So these various emanations come into the world, and they have relationship with the children of Ulutar. There are two types of children of Ulutar in the world. There's the human, and then there are the elves. The whole drama has been set up before elves or humans awaken. Now you ask, what myth is this like? Well, I'd say, first of all, it's a lot like most Gnostic creation mythologies, in that it is emanational, that there is a first source. That first source emanates into a variety of powers, forces of different types, often referred to as children. That these enter into the direct relationship of creation, that they are demiurgs, and this is exactly what the word that Tolkien uses, is he refers to the Ainur as demiurgs, demiurgic forces, forming forces, and that in this creation, a darkness enters in, a darkness of chaos, a darkness that would control the world and order it to its own power, who is Melko, this dark, chaotic force. The myth, really, when we look at the cosmogonic myth, I'd say the place it has its most interesting locus of conjunction is with the Manichaean myth. In Mani's myth, there is a realm of light, and the realm of light is invaded by a dark force, by a force from outside of the light, which hungers after the light. And that is really the beginning of the whole cosmogonic story. The Manichaean myth has a period of before the mixing of the elements, then during the mixing of the light and the dark, and then a period that will happen after. We live in the period of the mixing. That's cosmos. The entire Manichaean myth sets a stage of what happened before cosmogenesis. And cosmogenesis itself is an effort to rescue the light from the mixing. In the Manichaean myth, the realm of light is invaded by a darkness. And into the darkness are thrown, sort of as a sacrifice or as a battle plan, five of the sons of the god force. And that's the beginning of the mixing. These five children of light enter in to a mix in the darkness, are essentially consumed by the darkness, and thereby enter into the creation. One sees some of this in Tolkien's image. But to be, you know, there's no exact parallel. The point is that there's a mythopoetic imagination which is working with just these sorts of themes, which is really quite extraordinary.
It's very extraordinary. And beyond that, and beyond the evidence you showed us of how Tolkien entered into the world of archetypes, which I guess he called the fairy world, and Jung took a similar journey, but his worldview seems to be eerily Gnostic. I mean, you do quote him in your lecture saying that he said, "We are free captives undermining shadowy bars, and they were trapped in a great artifact."
Yeah, one can look at Tolkien's cosmogonic myth as a literary creation, but one must understand that Tolkien was drawing conclusions. Tolkien was discovering something in the imaginal and was then drawing conclusions from it about the nature of life, of human reality, about how we stand, we humans stand at this particular point in time. And he came to see that indeed we are imprisoned. And that particular story, that myth that poem that you just quote, was written to C.S. Lewis in 1931. This is 1931. It's 12 years after the Einar and Andale has come, the music of the gods, the creation myth has come to Tolkien. And he's trying to indicate to C.S. Lewis, who at that time is relatively agnostic, and he believes there may be a god, but he can't see how the myth of Christ has anything to do with anything. And he writes this long poem called Mythopoeia, the source the of myth. And he writes it from Philomythos to Misomythos, the lover of myth to the hater of myth, himself being a lover of myth, C.S. Lewis and being a hater. And he goes through this very long, probably about 10 pages, 8 pages long poem in double-spaced. And he gives exactly that sense. He's trying to explain creation. He says, trees are not trees until so named, and never were so named till those had been whose speech's involuted breath unfurled, faint echo and dim picture of the world. And he goes on to say that, but neither record nor photograph, being divination, judgment, and a laugh, response of those that felt a stir within by deep monition movement, that were kin to life and death of trees, of beasts, of stars. And then comes this description of who these people were, this image of the human consciousness. It says, we are free captives, undermining shadowy bars. Free captives undermining shadowy bars. And isn't that the key image of the exile in Gnostic mythology?
Oh, yeah.
And he says, digging the foreknown from experience and panning the vein of spirit out of sense. Digging the foreknown. Okay, digging the foreknown from experience. Well, what sort of experience is that? It's the foreknown, that thing, that epinoia, that first knowledge is being dug from experience. But what sort of experience? Imaginal experience. Experience of the inner realm. And he goes on, digging the foreknown from experience and panning the vein of spirit out of sense. You know, we have this sensory perception of the outer world. But there is also a spirit, and we pan that vein of gold, of spirit, with out of sense. And then he goes on speaking of the evolution of human consciousness. He says, great powers, they slowly brought out of themselves, speaking of mankind, great powers they slowly brought out of themselves, and looking backward, they beheld the elves that wrought on cunning forges in the mind and light and dark on secret looms entwined. He sees no stars who does not see them first of silver made that sudden burst to flame like flowers beneath the ancient song, whose very echo after music long has since pursued. There is no firmament, only a void, and less a jeweled tent, myth woven. An elf patterned, and no earth unless the mother's womb, once all have birth. So the heaven is just a void, unless we see it as that jeweled myth-woven tent, the inner reality of our imagination, which gives meaning to that void of stars, that we project out into that realm our stories, the stories we tell, that myth-woven tent within which we reside. So, you know, he's dealing with this mythology. He's dealing with this sense of exile throughout his mythology. And that sense of the exile, the Gnostic exile, is very much present in all of Tolkien's work.
But obviously Tolkien, Lance, was a practicing Catholic all through his life. But I'm sure what some of the listeners would like to know, as far as you know, did he ever have any contact with esoteric or occult agencies beyond whatever paganism he might have studied in his life?
Yes. And yes, and was it influential upon him? Perhaps no. The main influence on Tolkien was his own imaginal experience. When people look at his mythology, when people read his books, there is a school of thought which would tend, because he was a philologist, because he had great knowledge of ancient texts, medieval texts principally, that these were influences upon his work, and he was taking pieces of this and pieces of that and blending them together into his own mythology, and that's simply not the case. The man had his own experience of an imaginal world, and from it he created, he discovered and recorded and interpreted his mythology from that experience. He was most definitely a Christian. He was deeply devoted to the Eucharistic ritual, to the mystery of the Eucharist, and to the Christian myth, a story which he considered true. Myths sometimes are true. True stories change history. True stories make history. True stories perhaps come before history, and history is an echo of a story. He saw that definitely in the Christian myth. You know, people talk about Tolkien as a good Roman Catholic and try to find images of Catholic dogma, I suppose, within some of his writings, and that's in a way bizarre. There are elements of Catholic dogma which are certainly profoundly called into question by Tolkien's mythology. The principal one is the reality of evil. Within Tolkien's mythology, evil is a force existent in cosmos before the awakening of men, before the awakening of human consciousness, which goes entirely against the privatio boni, the whole concept that evil is only the privation of good. You know, Tolkien in his myth, in that poem that you just brought up a minute ago, Mythopoeia, one of his declarations is that evil is a reality. You just have to look at The Lord of the Rings and you'll see that Sauron is evil and evil is
yeah,
a reality.
No doubt.
And if you go back through his mythology, before Sauron, there's Morgoth. Morgoth is the form in world of Melkor, that first force of darkness, that first force of discord. So that, you know, that really stands in contrast to a basic fundamental issue in Catholic theology. So, but Tolkien was a Catholic. In what way was he Catholic? He was Catholic. Well, I mean, you could say, in every way he was Catholic, but he was deeply devoted to the sacramental form of the Church. He was a man who went to confession and took communion many days of his adult life, and he took that very seriously. His eldest son became a priest. As a young man, he had served Mass every morning before going to school. He was an orphan, and he was raised by a Catholic priest after the age of about 12. So, you know, he had a deep relationship to the sacramental system of the Church. He felt that in the sacramental system, there was a truth and a nourishment, that in the Eucharistic ritual, there was a nourishment. One was entering into a true story, into a true myth, and in that, there was sustenance. So, you know, Tolkien's Catholicism should not be doubted at that sense, and that devotion to the Eucharistic, to the validity of the Eucharistic ritual. To transpose that into a restatement of Catholic dogma somehow hidden within his works, I think, is bizarre. But, you know, in the 1920s and 1930s, at the time that Tolkien was interested in his in developing his mythology and searching for others who might see this inner realm. There are a lot of esoteric sorts wandering around. Now, if you look at Jung in Zurich, by 1930, he was searching for ways of understanding what had happened to him. And he found that in alchemy, in the esoteric traditions of the West. And subsequently, he found it also imaged in Kabbalah. He saw that there were other human beings who had entered into the imaginal realm, and that these, call them systems, or call them traditions, were echoes of a valid human experience of this inner mythopoetic reality. He saw that definitely in alchemical mysticism. He saw that in Hermeticism, and eventually he saw that also clearly present in the Jewish systems of Kabbalah. Well, it so happens that in England, there was a fellow by the name of Charles Williams who had been involved with A.E. Waite, with the Order of the Rosy Cross. A.E. Waite, for those who don't know esoteric history too well, had been a member, one of the original members of the Golden Dawn. And about the time Crowley came along, he separated himself from the Golden Dawn and from its more goetic magical procedures, petitionary and commanding magical procedures, to a more religious, shall we say, grail-oriented mystery, and he called it the Order of the Rosy Cross. Well, Charles Williams was part of that. Charles Williams was an editor at the Oxford Press. He was deeply involved in alchemical and Kabbalistic ritual and mysticism. He went through, I think, spent about 15 years with A.E. Waite and went through many of the rituals of the Order of the Rosy Cross. In 1939, he went to Oxford and became a very close friend and associate of Tolkien's. He was a friend of C.S. Lewis. At this point, from 1930 onward through the late 1940s, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien were extremely close friends. They met at least twice a week. They had beer once or twice a week at the pub, and then usually we'd get together on Thursday nights in C.S. Lewis's rooms to read papers and have discussions and drink whiskey and beer and smoke pipes late into the night. And three or four or five or six other people would come, but C.S. Lewis and Tolkien were really the center of this group, C.S. Lewis being the anchor. And when Charles Williams came to Oxford in 1939, he almost immediately entered into this group and became one of the Inklings, as they're called, a very informal group it was, but it certainly had stable members. And from 1938 until 1945, when Williams died, he was a close associate of Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. Tolkien and Williams definitely had conversations, and Tolkien encountered in Williams this entire, shall we say, more esoteric view of Christianity, an hermetic Christianity. He didn't understand it. He didn't get it. He didn't get Charles. He didn't understand his mythology. He didn't understand how it related. This becomes pretty clear in some of the things he wrote privately during this period. But he loved Charles. He saw that in the glint in his eyes, there was an authentic experience. So Tolkien really struggled with Charles Williams, trying to understand his take. He saw a bit of a black magician in him. And yet, nonetheless, he understood that he was still contacting something of a validity. So I would not say that Tolkien was influenced by Williams or brought into contact or understanding of esoteric systems such as alchemy, such as Kabbalah, such as Jung. But he sure as heck was aware of them. And then there was another figure that was a dear friend of C.S. Lewis's by the name of Owen Barfield. And Barfield was a disciple of Steiner, Rudolf Steiner, and he was an anthroposophist. And Barfield was a close friend of C.S. Lewis's and was a member of this group of Tolkien buddies from the 1930s through the 1950s, as when the Tolkiens actually met. I guess they stopped really meeting at the end of the 40s, around 1949, I think was the end of their meetings. But for those 18 years, Barfield was a frequent visitor. He was a very good friend and a more frequent companion of C.S. Lewis's, but Lewis and Tolkien were so close, the Tolkien got a lot of stuff from Barfield. And Barfield was very much into the anthroposophical worldview. He was also considered himself Christian at the same time. Barfield is an amazing fellow. And if there were any influence upon Tolkien from that realm, shall we say, it would be Barfield. Because Barfield clearly did have some effects. And in fact, effects that Tolkien admitted around 1930, one of Barfield's very early books on words, on the history of word, the history of word as an expression of human experience, deeply influenced Tolkien at a critical point in the 30s. So one thinks of the Inklings as this group of Christian gentlemen, and one forgets the fact that these guys are occasionally drinking a bit too much whiskey and smoking a bit too many pipes and becoming extremely boisterous at the same time they were sharing their writings, and that the people in that group sharing writings included Barfield, an anthroposophist, and Williams, a hermetic Christian with initiatory background in an esoteric Order of the Rosy Cross, which had associations with the Golden Dawn. And then there's another fellow by the name of Hovard, who was at one time a Freudian analyst.
Wow.
A physician who was a Freudian analyst. And this was Hovard was Tolkien's personal physician all of his life. So the Inklings really were an extremely diverse group of individuals. The thing that tied them together was not just their Christianity. It is their essential interest in the reality of the imagined, that there was an interior soulful reality as infinite as the world we see without, and that that realm needed our attention and needed our experiential encounter. He was also, I should add, Tolkien was probably by the 1930s aware of Jung. When he went to write his great essay on fairy stories, he makes mention in his notes of an intention to mention both Jung and the psychology of the unconscious. This was in 1930. He was writing those notes in 1938 through 1943. And someplace in there, at that time, he was aware, certainly, of Jung. He was also involved with Oxford Christian culture. And in Oxford, there was the Blackfriars, the Dominican order at Oxford. And there was one of the priests there in the Dominican order who was very, very, very close to Jung from 1946 through the early 1950s by the name of Father Victor White. And Victor White was working as a Catholic priest. He was a Dominican friar, and he was a Jungian analyst unofficially. And it would be hard to conceive of Tolkien not having had some contact with the name of Jung and his psychology, especially, you know, in conversations over many years with Barfield and with Williams.
And Lance, to end things, and I feel this is important for the listeners, especially all of us who are seekers, who are on our path of gnosis and self-knowledge and so forth. But, and I found this almost troubling and very sad when I was listening to your lectures, but you talk, at one point, Tolkien actually became, and I guess this is what separates him from Jung, but he became severed from the source, from that fountainhead of imagination. How could that have happened?
Well, that is really a very interesting question.
And an important one for all of us, because, you know, it could happen to any one of us.
Well, for it to happen, something else has to be, you know, there's a presence and an absence in that word. First of all, there has to be a presence of an experience before there can be its absence. And the type of experience that Tolkien underwent and that Jung underwent had an intensity and a reality, a presence that very few of us, very, very few of us can comprehend through our own experience. We may get inklings of it. But these men went so much further into that imaginative reality. If one looks at individuals who have such experience, well, my own perception as a physician taking care of lots of people over 30 years is that not many people have experiences like Jung and Tolkien. In a generation of world, there are only a few people who really have that sort of depth of experience. And those doors don't stay wide open for an entire lifetime. When Jung entered his imaginal realm, the doors swang wide open around 1914 and began to close. That intense visionary experience was really closing off by the 1920s, early 1920s. Not to say it was not always available to him to some degree, but that sort of visionary material was not a lifelong experience. For Tolkien, the doors really swang open wide in late 1916, 1917, 18, 19, through the 20s. He worked on the material continuously through the 30s, up to the time he started writing The Lord of the Rings, which was an entirely different type of experience for him around 1938. He started that and finished in 48, 49. But in the 1950s, Tolkien went back. He wanted to publish The Silmarillion. He wanted to publish these initial vision texts that had come to him. The problem was they were not a book. They were not a single story. They were not a literary form. And he went back and he tried to bring them forward. And as it was into some form that would be able to be published, something that would be intelligible to people who had read The Lord of the Rings, and he simply could not do it. They were primary manifestations of a mythopoetic imagination. They were fragmentary. They did not have literary context. The only context was his experience. And what he discovered as he went back is he couldn't rewrite them. He couldn't change them. He could not enter again into the imaginative world as he had 30 years earlier. There was a sense of bereavement in that experience, and Tolkien wrote a story called The Smith of Bolton Major about this fact, that a man or woman can enter into the imaginal to great intensity and depth, as he had. But a time comes when one must leave. One can return to its memory, always. One can perhaps return to the environs, the edges of that realm of imagination. But at a point in life, one cannot go back into the heart of it again. It's happened. It's happened, and it is not repeated. So if one looks at the creative life of many individuals, one sees that there's this period, this seminal period of deep imaginative of fire. And it does not last forever. This comes down to this whole idea of pistis in Gnosticism. You know, we have some intense experiences. And the more intense, the more valid, the more true, the more deep they are, the less likely they are to be repeated on a daily basis. They're special because they are special. They are different because they are so different. They are deep because they are so deep. And we cannot live in that experience perpetually, but once we have had the experience, the question is, can we remain faithful to it? Can we remember it? Can we serve it? So Jung was not having visions all of his life in intensity and complexity that he was having during his confrontation with the unconscious, as it's called. But he certainly served that experience all his life. Tolkien was not able to return to the realm of fairy as intensely at age 60 as he had at age 25 and 30. But he continued to serve, to consider, to forward that experience. There's one last thing I'd like to say that I think is important. Both of these men saw that the story that they were encountering had relevance to our world, our time, our history. Both of them believed that the imaginative realm, the story that they encountered, was real and true, and that it crossed history, that it impacted history, that the story that they heard touched history. Tolkien and Jung shared a vision that we were near an end of a time. Jung felt this was the end of the third month of human history, that we were about to begin the Age of Aquarius, the fourth chapter of the tale of human consciousness, and that this was a critical period. We were at the end of an ion, the end of a vast age of 2,000 years, and something new was about to begin. That was really part and parcel and primary form of this vision that came to him back in 1914, that we were at the beginning of a new age, and that this revelation that he had in some fashion impacted that story he was telling was critical to this coming new age, a Sophianic age, one might declare it in Jung's view. Tolkien had the same vision. What's the Lord of the Rings about? The end of the Third Age. Tolkien's story is not something lost in history. It's not something placed in some ancient realm of history. That's how we see it. You know, it's like, oh yeah, he's talking about medieval times. He's making up pagan myths. You know, bull patootie. Tolkien's story is a fact he encountered as real, as true, as a discovery which is a story that will touch this time. The ring is not yet in Mount Doom. The war is still engaged, and each and every one of us, within the framework of Tolkien's myth, are a bit like Frodo. We all have that burden in this age, but this age will end. If, indeed, we can get the ring to Mount Doom. So, you see, he really felt that story touched history. And I could go on for hours and explain to you how he saw that, but and how specifically he saw it. But I assure you, he did see that his story had relevance to this age and was a story that would impact the consciousness of this age. And I believe it has. 250 million books later, The Lord of the Rings has penetrated well into modern consciousness. You know, what was Gnosticism about? What happened 2,000 years ago? It was the beginning of an ion, wasn't it?
Uh-huh.
Beginning of a new age. And that gnosis, that Gnostic vision struggled. It came forward. It was present. The imaginal was a reality. People say, what's Gnosticism? It's like, you know, okay, I'll tell you what Gnosticism is. It's an experience of the imaginal. It's mythopoetic imagination. And that experience of the imaginal, that mythopoetic imagination, is understood to be an experience of a reality. And then part two, it's the interpretation of the experience into textual and mythic form. So you want to look for coherence in the term Gnostic. You know, is there such a thing? Is there Gnosticism? And I say, yes, Gnosticism is defined by its hermeneutic. It's defined by the experience and the interpretation of genuine experience. And that happened 2,000 years ago. And unfortunately, the great demiurge has taken power in our world. The rational, materialistic, that shuts us off from accepting the fact that there's something more, that there is spirit, that there is interior, that there is light, that there is a spark that is born before and will proceed after what we call time. We've lost that. And we are at the end of an age where the great hope is that it will be remembered. And that's what Jung struggled all of his life as a result of his revelations, and he called them revelations. He really felt that he was called to form a new religion. At one point in 1920, that's what his soul told him in a revelation. Is, you know, you must declare the new religion. But he didn't declare religion. What he did is declare the fact of the reality of the inner world, of the spirit, and tried to return people's consciousness to the power and form of myth. Tolkien was very much in a similar place, and he understood that myth would touch history. And I really believe that in 200 years we will find, not you and I, but humankind speaking generally, will find that it was so, that they have touched it.
Indeed it has. There's no arguing about that. Well, I think that's all the time we have today, Lance. I'd like to thank you very much for coming on Aeon Byte and giving us a very stimulating and erudite conversation on Tolkien.
Well, I'm pleased to have the opportunity. Thank you very much.